Public Radio KMXT is supported by a grant from North Pacific Fuel, serving and continuing the tradition of excellent service to the community at three locations: Marine Dock at 715 Shelikoff Street, Gas & Go at the Y, and Gas & Go at Mill Bay.
It's nearly 12 o'clock, and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center has been recognized with a national award for sustainability. The medical facility was one of 99 winners of the Partner Recognition Award from the organization Project Green Health. Recipients, quote, have a commitment to environmental improvements and have achieved progress, close quote, in implementing more sustainable practices at their facilities, according to the organization's website. Darcy Moxon is Providence's Sustainability Program Manager for Alaska.
I think it really just shows a commitment that we are serious about this being a part of our mission and this being work that we feel is so important. It's really for our communities, because community health and environmental stewardship are related.
Moxon says Providence's hospital in Kodiak has been giving lightly used items to the community, including bed linens, hospital beds, and unused medical devices, instead of throwing them away. Food scraps are sent to local farmers for compost, according to Moxon, and unused food is donated to local food banks. The facility has also been improving its recycling program. Moxon says Kodiak, being an island, is a natural fit for environmental initiatives.
And so that culture of reuse and, you know, getting the maximum life out of something without throwing it away is really strong in Kodiak.
This is the first year the Providence Medical Campus in Kodiak has been recognized for its efforts towards sustainability. Providence's healthcare system announced in 2020 a goal of becoming carbon negative by 2030 and to reduce waste by 50% across all its facilities. For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. There's an intricate world of plants that make up the muskeg bogs on the islands of Southeast Alaska. Some of those plants may hold clues for how people can store water in the future or grow more disease-resistant food. KFSK's Catherine Monahan learned more than she expected to during a recent tour of Petersburg's lichens and mosses.
It's a bright, misty evening in Petersburg's muskegs. A group of people in raincoats and rubber boots heads out the Hungry Point Trail and steps into an ancient peat bog that sucks at their boots.
I mean, it's an amazing sponge, and it stores water to feed the salmon streams when it's super hot. Amazing filtration.
That's Joni Johnson, who's leading the walk along with fellow U.S. Forest Service ecologist Karen Dillman. As Dillman points out the structures of the tiny plants around us, the incredible complexity begins to reveal itself.
So lichens are fungi that have learned how to cultivate algae to photosynthesize for them, and they take the sugars of the algae to live. Because look at it, there's no roots, it's just living in water, it's absorbing all the water, it might get some of the nutrients from the water, but not really, it's more the photosynthetic properties of the algal partner.
As it turns out, along on the tour is a group of world-class experts. They're visiting Petersburg on their way to the Botanical Society of America's annual conference, which this year takes place in Anchorage. There's a specialist in insectivorous plants, crouching down to peer through a magnifier at the bright, spiny insect eaters, and a PhD student specializing in sphagnum mosses, who's almost leaping about like a kid at an Easter egg hunt, collecting specimens and wrapping them in paper.
This is called sphagnum quinquefarium. This is a species that is found in forests. Mostly in forest.
Nearby, Philip Shushkov is swatting at no-see-ums. He's a theoretical chemist with Indiana University and hopes that mosses will give him ideas for his research in genetic engineering.
They have certain cell types that have that sort of ancestral, that have developed before the cell types in vascular plants. And we've been actually discussing quite a bit how to actually leverage this single-cell technology. And then basically this will give us clues how to engineer it and change it in the future for our needs.
Here's Shushkov's research partner, Luke Nikolov from UCLA.
Moss is able to retain more than 10 times its own weight in water, We don't know how this is done. This is done through a specialized cell type that is able to do that. Well, we can think of many different reasons why we would like to invent a material that is able to carry that much water. And we can use this knowledge of how you would produce this particular cell type for bioengineering or biologically inspired design of materials.
Nikolov, who specializes in flowers, creates theories on how plants' genes direct their development. Then Shushkov builds mathematical and chemical models of these theories to test them out. And then the results of their experiments can be used, for example, to help engineer stronger blueberry crops. Nikolov is amazed at all the different varieties of blueberry growing in the muskeg. He says the monocultures grown for mass consumption are vulnerable to getting wiped out entirely by fungus or parasites, even as the world population increases.
It's a very precarious time as well, because much of that wild diversity that we see around us is disappearing very fast, much faster than we can actually study it. So we're losing invaluable resources, genetic resources that we could actually use and harness to make better crops that will feed us for centuries ahead.
That's why, he says, it's important to visit places like Petersburg, where vital knowledge can be gleaned from an ancient, intricately balanced ecosystem. Though species are rapidly dying out across much of the globe, here in the muskeg, nature seems intact and eternal. In Petersburg, I'm Catherine Monahan.
Global markets unsettled by the war in Ukraine have bumped up gas prices and disrupted energy supply chains in the U.S. and abroad. Boosters of the long-sought Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project say those same factors make it the perfect time to invest in their plan to build the $39 billion project. But they're not the only ones trying to seize the opportunity. And analysts say stiff competition could continue to keep Alaska's North Slope gas in the ground.
For decades, Alaska was Japan's sole supplier of liquefied natural gas, a transportable version of the substance used to heat homes and electrify power plants. Those exports stopped when competition from other producers edged Alaska out of the picture. But this month, Brad Chastain told an audience in Kenai that Japan is once again interested in importing natural gas from Alaska, and that his project is the best way to get it there.
And the best way I can describe it is every planet possible that we can think of is aligned right now.
Chastain manages the Alaska LNG project, which would construct an 800-foot pipeline to send North Slope natural gas to Nikiski, where it would be liquefied, shipped out, and sold. It's been on the table for as long as Alaska's been an energy state, though the steep costs of constructing the pipeline have been too prohibitive to make it a reality so far. That was before global demand for LNG shot up. Today, overseas buyers are desperate for gas as they look to move away from their dependence on Russia, which has historically supplied some European countries with as much as half of their supply. Russia, in turn, is responding to the opposition by cutting off its natural gas flow to Europe.
And so what's happening is that Europe is sucking up all available LNG, and everyone is paying the price.
Ben Cahill is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He says natural gas prices in Europe rose last summer, before Russia invaded Ukraine. But the war has supercharged that crisis. He says LNG project developers are noticing, and like Alaska LNG, are trying to push their projects to the finish line, while the timing seems right.
There are a lot of proposed LNG projects. There's no way that they can all move forward.
He says to get projects financed, producers first have to convince buyers they have long-term supply and that their project rises above the others, which he says mostly comes down to cost. The high project cost has stymied the Alaska plan in the past. Cahill says he still sees that as a big hurdle. Larry Persily says that hurdle is simply too large to overlook. Persily was previously tasked with getting an Alaska gas line built under President Barack Obama. And he says with all the competition, there's no way Alaska LNG will come out on top.
The cost and the risk and the fact that there are a lot more projects out there that are less risky and a lot cheaper than ours.
Many of the new proposed gas projects are on the country's Gulf Coast, which is the top exporter of LNG worldwide. Gas and the cost of shipping it out are generally cheaper there. Plus, Persily says he's skeptical that buyers overseas will want to sign long-term contracts with gas companies anyway, as renewable energy picks up steam.
And that move has been accelerated by the high cost of oil and gas.
Industry analyst Jason Fear says it's true the Gulf Coast is better positioned to deliver gas to Europe. But he says Alaska has at least one advantage over its competitors, its proximity to Asia.
So I think that sort of dynamic where you may see Gulf Coast LNG being pulled to Europe may create opportunities for projects on the West Coast. So I think that's a very interesting dynamic.
He says demand for gas in Asia is high too, and he doesn't see it dropping anytime soon. This spring, Governor Mike Dunleavy visited Japan to talk up the plan. Fear says Japan has, for years, been the world's biggest importer of LNG.
So those are, you know, hugely significant markets, you know, that are accounting for the bulk or very significant shares of global LNG.
That demand in Asia and elsewhere is already driving a slate of natural gas projects toward development. Cahill says there's been an uptick in signed contracts in recent months as buyers look to secure their energy futures. But even if the planets are aligning, like Chastain says, there's still just no guarantee one of those contracts will be inked in Alaska. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Biologists say Alaska's known population of Aleutian terns has declined by more than 90% since 1960. Now a group of scientists is working on a statewide count to make sure they aren't overestimating the decline. KTOO's Claire Strimple has this report.
If researchers are right, this is the fastest decline of any seabird species in Alaska. And it's all the more serious because there just aren't that many Aleutian terns here to begin with.
It certainly feels like we are watching the species slowly disappear.
Heather Renner has been a biologist at Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge for about 2 decades.
The seabird group had been kind of hearing stories of declines in Aleutian terns as long as I've worked here. Really, the problem has been that nobody's been studying them.
There are an estimated 30,000 Aleutian terns worldwide, but Renner's research showed only about 5,000 of the birds nest in the state. That prompted a collective effort to understand and conserve them. Studying a migratory bird in a place as big as Alaska is not easy. Aleutian terns spend only 3 to 4 months a year here. Their range includes the whole coast of Alaska and extends nearly 10,000 miles to places like Indonesia, the Philippines, and Borneo.
Aleutian terns are notoriously hard to study because they nest in pretty small colonies and they're not very clustered. We also know that they tend to move around, so our little short-term snapshots are challenging to interpret.
The same characteristics that make them hard to study make them a sought-after find for birders and outdoor enthusiasts.
Aleutian terns are a really special bird that not everybody gets to see. They're not well-known to many Alaskan birders because many of the colonies are off of the road system.
They have silver-gray bodies and a black head like Arctic terns. But Aleutian terns have a distinctive white patch on the forehead. They feed by plunge diving into the sea. It isn't unusual anymore for a bird species population to crash. One study says that the entire bird population in North America has declined by about a third since the 1970s. Renner says biologists don't know what's causing the Aleutian tern's precipitous decline.
The challenge is that we don't have a local threat that's known, a single thing that we can fix. My best guess is that it's related to something in the marine environment.
One study pinned a die-off of Arctic terns to algal toxins that get to terns through the fish in their diet. But Renner says even though Aleutian terns also eat those fish, it's hard for her to imagine that could account for such broad-scale, range-wide declines over several decades. Yakutat has the largest known breeding colony of Aleutian terns in the state, at Black Sand Spit. Less than 10 years ago, there were up to 2,000 birds at the site.
And then the last couple years, it's been only several hundred.
Susan Ohlers is a biologist for the U.S. Forest Service there. She says there's a lot of variability in the yearly population count, even at what's considered a stable nesting area. That number has dropped into the hundreds before. She says when numbers drop, it could mean that some of the birds are nesting elsewhere. But the dramatic downward trend has spurred action among bird biologists statewide. The working group has members from several different state and federal agencies. They're doing direct counts, but also using tools like drones and song meters
to really get a handle on that number and, you know, validate and provide additional information from that 2015 paper.
They plan to have a solid population estimate in the next couple of years. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Claire Strempel.
Governor Mike Dunleavy signed a bill on Thursday that lets tribes apply to create state tribal compact schools. The bill creates a pilot program for Alaska Native tribes to run their own public schools with their own K through 12 curriculum. Tribes can currently apply to create charter schools, but those are connected to a local school district. State tribal compacts would allow tribes to operate much like school districts. At a bill signing ceremony at the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage, Dunleavy said compact agreements between the state and tribes could help improve education outcomes, expand school choice, and respect Alaska Native culture.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.